sorry, Miss Claudia. I hate to do it. I hate to turn down that good music, but I got something that's even better. His name is Walden Hughes. Walden, how are you, big boy?
We're doing good, Bill.
Doing good and having fun, aren't we?
What a night.
Yes, sir. Boy, this is the kind of night that you have every now and then. Sometimes we don't have it often enough, but we're here, and we're going to have a good time. We've got the owner of what I call the $10 million Magic Castle. And his name is Milt Larson. Milt, how are you doing, sir?
Very good. Do you have the $10 million in cash, or can I get it tonight? Or you want to write me one of your famous checks for it, or what?
Well, am I correct? I think I'm a little low on that.
I don't know. We've never kind of... You know, the castle has been around for 40 years, and I suppose if you put a couple of bucks in it every year, it would mount up. But it's not something you really look at in the terms of money. It's a wonderful place for magicians to magish and people to fool each other, and I've been fooling people for 40 years, so, including you. You think I'm here.
As a matter of fact, you got me fooled right now.
I'm a hologram.
Oh, yeah. And a pretty one at that.
Thank you.
But let me tell you this. Someone that cannot be fooled by anyone is on our telephone line right now. She's very beautiful. She's very wonderful. She's very kind, and she's very famous. Not necessarily in that order. Joan Benny, good evening. I love you. How are you, my dear?
Well, I'm just fine, Bill. How are you?
Oh, we are wonderful. We are having a grand time here in Hollywood, and it is so nice to be in your neighborhood.
Well, I'm so thrilled. I have to tell you that Milt Larson is on the show because I am a big fan of Magic Castle.
Well, thank you.
I'm not a member. I've only been there once. I had the best time of my life.
Well, you've got to come again.
So, am I invited?
You're darn right.
Oh, wow.
Give me a call anytime.
I can't wait. That was really an experience. It was some years ago, and at that time, I lived with my parents next door to Lucy. And
oh, sure.
And then it was Desi. And I came with them, with Lucy and Desi, and with Tony Curtis.
Oh, fine.
Married to I don't remember whom, probably Janice. And anyway, we had a great time.
Well, those are memorable evenings when a bunch of people like you come into the castle. And of course, Tony's still very active with it, and you know, and he only played Houdini once, but he's never forgotten it.
So. It was a great role for him.
Oh, definitely. And you know, Jack was my brother worked with Jack. My brother was at CBS for years and years and years, and what a lovely man. So. What can you say about him?
Joan, we were speaking of restaurants. There's only one restaurant that is better than the Magic Castle, and it's not here any longer, so it's okay to mention it.
Barney's Beanery?
Oh, no.
I can think of a few.
The Brown Derby. The Brown Derby, and we were up at the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, and they have a beautiful, beautiful display of pictures. And Kim and I were just marveling at the many times and the many pictures of your mom and dad.
You're
at the Brown,
about the Brown Derby.
At the Brown Derby. Did you ever go to the Brown Derby with them?
Oh, my God, yes. Many, many times.
Tell us, what was it like in the Brown Derby? I mean, that must have been a wonderful place. They have a booth, a recreation of a booth there. Tell us about the Brown Derby. Paint a picture for us what it was like to have dinner at the Brown Derby.
Well, it was much like having dinner. You know, there were three restaurants here that were famous because celebrities who went. One was Romanoff's, one was Chasen's, and the other was the Brown Derby. And I think the most memorable thing about the Brown Derby, of course, were all the pictures on the walls and the booths. I mean, I can see it very clearly. I don't think I went to the one in Hollywood very often, but we had one right here in Beverly Hills. On, I believe it was the corner of Wilshire and Rodeo, or Wilshire and Bedford. Anyway, that, you know what I remember most? This is very funny. George Raft. He was always there. And I remember their fabulous spaghetti and their particularly wonderful Cobb salad. And I have the book. There's a book on the Brown Derby.
Yes, there is, and there are a couple of recipe books as well.
I know, because that Brown Derby book has that original recipe for the Cobb salad, for the black bottom pie, and for that spaghetti. And I've made it for company, and I get raised with the spaghetti.
Well, let me tell you how ignorant I am, being from Texas. and not living in this area. I have seen Cobb salads on menus everywhere, all over the world. And I never ordered it because I thought it had little, you know, those little ears of corn that come in glass bottles. I thought that if I ordered a Cobb salad,
you got the Cobb,
it,
yeah,
it would have those corn, and I don't like those.
And they
things
have a lot of outhouses in Texas.
Right. So I found out on this trip to Hollywood that there was a man named Cobb,
Bob Cobb,
who owned the Brown Derby.
That's
and,
right.
And he one night he cleaned out the, what they told us. One night he cleaned out the refrigerator and made a salad. And a couple of celebrities came in and said, "Hey, Bob, what you having over there?" He said, "Well, just a little salad." And they said, well, make us one, too. So he made three of them, and they ranted, and they raved, and they ate every bite. And so from that day on, he continued to make them, and he put them on the menu, and he said, "Hey, I need a name for these." So he decided to call them a Cobb salad. Am I anywhere close to right?
I'm not so sure about the story as to how it was invented, but I can tell you one thing, that the Cobb salad, as you know, is very popular in restaurants from New York to California, and it's very difficult, I mean really difficult, to get a real Cobb salad, that original recipe.
You know, the only real Cobb salad is at the Magic Castle, and that's because Peggy Cobb is a member of the castle, and that's Peggy Cobb.
Oh Lord, I went
is the daughter.
High school together.
Yeah, well, that's it. And yep. Peggy, we were talking to Peggy one time. Actually, we went to a party and they had the Cobb salad the way it should be made. And Peggy had made it, and so I said, "Would you come and show our people at the castle how a real Cobb salad should be made?" And she said that her father, Bob, had said that the proper Cobb salad was chopped fine enough that it had to be mushy, and that was his word. It has to be a mushy salad. And we serve Cobb salad. Our maitre d' at the castle, David Aguirre, was a waiter at the Derby. And we have the alumni, when they closed the Derby, they just all came over to our place. Mm-hmm. But the only place that you can really get a real Cobb salad is the Magic Castle and Universal in Florida. But they sent their chef to the Magic Castle to learn how to make it. So there.
Well, tell us, without giving away the recipe.
Hello? Note. Wait a minute.
Okay.
Add one more place. My house.
Oh, okay. Okay, well, we'll come to your house then. That seems like a better deal.
Well, Milt, without giving away any secrets, for those other Texans down there who are listening tonight, what are some of, don't tell us all, but what are some
well,
of the things?
Well, in the first place,
we'll
there
find?
Are no corn cobs in it.
No corn cobs. Thank goodness.
Yeah. Now, a Cobb salad is basically, now, if you go any place in the world, and I've made a study of this, every place I go, I order a Cobb salad just to see how they can screw it up, because it's amazing. They put big chunks of turkey and things, but basically the proper Cobb salad is it's chopped up turkey. It's a chopped salad. There are very few chopped salads. There were at the time he invented it, but it's turkey and tomatoes and avocados, bacon, if you prefer,
blue cheese,
and lettuce, romaine and iceberg lettuce. And the theory is that they're all chopped individually, and then the presentation, which we do at the castle, is they're put in strips across the bowl, so they're all in separate. And then the waiter properly says, "You want it mixed or not?" And then they look at it, and then everybody scrambles it all up. And a proper Cobb salad dressing, incidentally, which I have threatened to shoot the waiters at the Magic Castle, is they will, somebody will order a Cobb salad, and they say, "What dressing you want?" Well, you can't say that. You're supposed to have a Cobb salad with Bob Cobb's dressing, which was basically just a French dressing, oil and vinegar. And there's a marvelous book do you remember Mike Roy?
No.
He was had a radio show, and he was a chef, and he was a very dear friend of all the radio personalities in L.A. And he wrote some cookbooks, and he has the original Cobb salad in one of his cookbooks. He died 30, 40 years ago. I don't know, but at any rate, so that's the Cobb salad then.
The recipe is in the Brown Derby cookbook.
Oh, yeah.
It's called the Brown Derby Restaurant, and it was edited or written by Sally Cobb. Bob's widow.
Mm-hmm.
And the recipe is in there, as a matter of fact. I just got it out because I have the book right here.
But it's easy to do, and, you know, but people just make it wrong. And they don't understand what a Cobb salad is. And, you know, a Cobb salad is not pieces of this and pieces of that. It's a chopped salad, and it should be done properly. And Peggy Cobb will come over to anybody's house and show them how to make it.
I have a very funny story about the Brown Derby, apropos of nothing, but in Disney World in Florida, they have a replica of the Brown Derby. Have any of you been there?
Right.
And here's the Cobb salad. What did we do? Chicken breast,
mm-hmm.
iceberg, romaine, watercress, chicory, chopped chives, tomatoes, avocados, bacon, and hard-boiled eggs, and Roquefort cheese.
That has nothing to do with a Cobb salad.
Pardon me?
It would have nothing to do with a Cobb salad.
That's the recipe in the Brown Derby cookbook.
Oh, really? Well, I don't know about that one.
No, I'm sure that's what you make.
Well, Joan, tell me something. There's not a lot of people around that were in your unique position to share this story and have this information for us. Tell us, what was life like in the Brown Derby? I heard that the Luella Parsons used to hang out there all the time, and she was the lady in Hollywood who could make you or break you. And I have heard that the acoustics were such in the Brown Derby that you could hear what people were saying at other tables. And Luella used to park herself at the table and listen, and that's where she got all of her tidbits of information.
That's very funny.
Have you ever heard that story?
No, I haven't. But, it's been many, many years, and I really don't remember it all that well. I was about to tell you at Disney World that they have the replica of the Brown Derby. So this is a few years ago, about 6 years ago, I took my grandson to Disney World, and we decided to have lunch. I said, come on, let's have lunch at the Brown Derby, and I was telling him a little bit about his great-grandfather, because he was too young to really know that, to know much about him. And we walked into the restaurant, and the very first picture on the wall right in front of us was my father and mother and Barbara Stanwyck and Bob Taylor.
That's wonderful. That's great.
So funny. I mean, we walked in, and I said, Benjamin, that's your great-grandfather right in front of you.
That's wonderful.
This is another great story that will tie every one of us here in the studio together tonight. We were watching some of the videos they have down there. Now, for many years, Milt Larson worked for Ralph Edwards. And, of course, Ralph Edwards was the man and the genius behind This Is Your Life.
Yes.
And they showed four or five clips. There was one of Milton Berle.
Mm-hmm.
There was one of William Frawley, and then there was one of Phil Harris, who, of course, was your dad's band leader.
Yes.
And what Ralph Edwards would do, apparently, and maybe Milt can fill us in on this because he was probably at the console when all of this happened, but Bob, the announcer, would come on and give the opening of the show and give a plug for Crest toothpaste or Prel shampoo.
Prel.
And then he would, he'd say, now we're going to switch over live to Ralph Edwards outside the Brown Derby. And Ralph would be right on the sidewalk, right by the door. And he'd say, well, now we have a very important person inside tonight. We're not going to tell you who it is, but we're going to show you in just a moment. Now come on inside. And the door would open and the lights would come on and they would shine in the camera. In those days it was black and white. Shine into the camera, and sometimes the camera would dim down and then flare back up, and then the camera would bumpity bump bump bump, and as they were rolling it over the door facing, and usually the lucky person, the celebrity of the evening, was probably sitting pretty close to the door, and Ralph Edwards would walk over and surprise them right there in the Brown Derby, and one of them was Phil Harris, and Phil stood up. What they would do is they'd let them talk for a moment, and then out of nowhere, Ralph Edwards would appear and would show them the book, and of course they knew then what was going to happen. So Phil Harris stood up, and he said, well, can I finish my drink? And Ralph Edwards, you could tell he was really on the spot there. He said, no, we've got to go right now. And we need to go right now. We have a car waiting for you right now. And Phil Harris started to go with him. He said, just one second. And he went back to the table, and he took a big swig. He said, now I'm ready. And then they would walk out, and, of course, that's all the cut we had. Milt, tell us what happened. Apparently, what appeared, let me tell you what appeared was happening, is they had a car standing by, and they would drive as fast as they could during the commercial to get over to the studio where they were doing the show.
Well, you had to realize that the time you're talking about was live television. And I was a writer on Truth or Consequences, but I worked for Ralph Edwards. And Ralph would do wonderful things, like occasionally call and ask me if I could keep people busy. So I got to meet people like Max Sennett and Stan Laurel and people like that. But the thing that you have to realize, they did the show from the El Capitan Theater, which is Hollywood and Vine, and that was a theater that was devoted to television, and a lot of shows at Colgate Comedy Hour and All-Star Review and things came from there. And but you, what you have to remember is in those days, the NBC studio was at Sunset and Vine, and when we did practical joke remotes and things, we could only go as far as the string on the camera would go. And the longest string they had would go to the Brown Derby. They had a line over to the Brown Derby. So, you know, this today, hell, you can put a TV studio in your pocket.
We've got one on the table
well,
here tonight,
right.
Yeah.
But in those days, you know, the little field camera that they'd use, it was about the size of an upright piano. And so it was really hard to surprise people. And so the only chance we really had, and that show is totally legitimate. I mean, there was no question. They never let anybody know that they were doing it, and it didn't backfire too often. But Ralph would maintain this huge secrecy type thing. And when they walked in the front door of the Brown Derby, somehow that all happened. But then when they surprise them, then the trick of the thing is they had to get them out of the Brown Derby and get them a block and a half up the street, which they put them in a limousine, but they could have run up there faster, but it sounded better to put them in a limousine. So they
right.
parked the limousine and ran them a block and a half up, and then the next shot after the one-minute commercial. Remember the days when we only had a one-minute commercial?
Oh, yeah. And
today, during the commercial break, you could build a house. You know?
Oh, tell me about it.
Anyway.
Funny story, too. They did another one with, forgot who the celebrity was, but Groucho Marx was sitting in the booth next to them. And Groucho, of course, was on the radio at the time, sponsored by Chrysler. And so when Ralph said, we have a car standing by, Groucho stood up on his knees and leaned over into the booth next to him, which is where all the action was, and he says, what kind of car is it by chance? And Ralph was so quick, he turned without even blinking an eye and said, it's a Chrysler, Groucho, of course, a Chrysler.
That's great. Well, you know, the highest rating on a radio show, on a quiz show, ever, was when Ralph Edwards on Truth or Consequences. Now, I did the Truth or Consequences when Bob Barker started doing it for daytime, but the show had been on the air for 15 years at that point, and I did it for 18 years. I mean, that's a long-run show. But the highest rating of any game show at that point was when they had the Walking Man contest, and that was a carryover, as we called it, and went from week to week, and the prizes built up and everything. And the Walking Man turned out to be Jack Benny.
Remember that?
Yeah. And it was just incredible, you know. And the whole country was on pins and needles to find out who the Walking Man was.
Boy, you're going back a lot of years.
Oh, yeah. I'm going back before anybody was born.
Well, how did Jack end up being the Walking Man?
At that point, they've had the Mrs. Hush contest. And that was a big sensation, and they wanted to repeat it. And at that point, Jack Benny was probably the best-known entertainer in the universe, but probably the last person you think of as this phantom person that is walking through with his hush puppies on and things. So I don't know how they did it. It was before I was on the show, but it just, in those days in live radio, of course, the Ralph Edwards Truth or Consequences radio show at the time in the 40s was the number one show in radio. I mean, it was just the number one show. And it was, I think, basically because Ralph was such a... he made radio become alive. When you watched Truth or Consequences on radio, and Ralph to this day, Ralph has just had his 89th birthday, and, you know, he's not working as much as he used to, but that fire is still there. And they, if you watch any of those old shows that Ralph did, or listen to the radio shows, it's marvelous, kind of a CD that they put out, some of the, you know, radio shows. And it's just exactly like you immediately, well, it's like watching anything on radio. You know, you mysteries and things. You see the people. You know, it's the unseen thing. Anyway, I'm getting away from the
interesting
point
what you said when
I
you
blabber
wa-
away.
When you said you watch it on radio.
Oh, yeah?
I love what you said then.
No, you could picture everything. When Ralph Edwards was doing these things with contestants, you could see them doing it, and you could see people doing silly things and squirting people with seltzer and all that stuff they did. But Ralph would make such a thing. Oh, there she is. Oh, look at that. Oh, my God. It's like a play-by-play on a football game, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's wonderful, you know.
It really is. Joan, you mentioned a moment ago you went to school with the Cobb daughter. What other daughters and sons did you go to school with?
Oh, there were so many of them.
I was going to say that.
Yes, I think... well, in high school, George Burns' daughter, and Louis B. Mayer's granddaughter, and at some point I went to school with Maria Cooper, Gary Cooper's daughter, and Joan Bennett's daughter, and let me see.
We drove by Hollywood High. Did you go to Hollywood High?
No, I didn't. I went to a private school called Chadwick,
mm-hmm.
and there were quite a few celebrity kids at Chadwick. I just don't remember them all, but it seems that I was surrounded. But I think everybody who lived in Beverly Hills, the west side of Los Angeles, it was such a show business community that you could hardly avoid celebrities' kids. They were all over the place.
Did you ever walk up to one of them and say,
about it, but...
"Say my daddy can beat up your daddy"?
The thing about it, of course, was growing up in that milieu, there was nothing that made me feel, because people say, you know, what was it like to be Jack Benny's daughter, and, you know, you were very special. And I said, not at all. I was just one of many other celebrities' kids. You know, we were, it sort of isn't everybody.
Right, and what you should have said is, what's it like not to be Jack Benny's daughter?
Right. No, my facetious answer is usually, I couldn't tell you because I've never been anybody else's.
Could you speak a little slower, Joan? So I'm trying to write down some of these. I'll get them in a moment here. Tell me about, this is an interesting story from the book Sunday Nights at 7. And tell us first about that book. How did that come about?
Oh, it was quite a few years in the making because I'd never written anything, and I certainly didn't consider myself a writer, and it was very difficult. That was hurdle number one. Hurdle number two was, how do you write a book about a nice man? There's no scan. I mean, it can't be Mommy Dearest, and it can't be Going My Own Way that Gary Crosby wrote. What do you do about a nice man who had one marriage, never any scandal attached to him? And I thought, nobody's going to buy this book. So that was hurdle number two. And hurdle number three, a title. And that came to me one day walking up Park Avenue, and the light bulb went on. I have to tell you very briefly, I was married to a man who was a producer, and he was the head of production for United Artists. And we had constant scripts at the house, and I read most of them, and then my husband would say, can you come up with a title? I never once, I'm the least creative person in the world, never once came up with a title that was any good at all, and I'm walking up Park Avenue, and the balloon, like in the cartoon, and I said, Sunday Nights at 7. That's a great title, Joan! I said, well, now I have to write the book on Sunday. Loved my title. So then Los Angeles, and I was sitting next to a very well-known writer, and I got up my nerve and said, excuse me, I know I shouldn't be bothering you, but I want to write a book. And I told him the circumstances, and I said, but I'm not a writer, and how do I begin? And he said, very simply, start with your most vivid memory. Oh, I said, my most vivid memory. And immediately I remembered that my father used to take me on drives on Sunday morning, and I must have been about maybe 6 years old, maybe even less, and the car wouldn't start unless I gave him a kiss. It's sweet, isn't it? I mean, it's a very sweet story.
Oh, yeah.
And that was, it just came to me like that, and I thought, okay, I've got my most vivid memory, and that's how I'll start, and that's how I wrote the book.
That's great.
Once I did that, then it just flowed after that, but it was interesting that those are the little things that started it.
There's a picture in that book of the swimming pool at your house.
With the oxygen, yes.
And there's a little boat in there. And I asked you about that. I said, wow, you had your own boat in your own swimming pool, and you don't remember that boat.
I don't remember it at all. But like the story of my grandson and going to the Brown Derby in Florida, I had never seen that picture. I had no memory of the boat. About 15 years ago, something like that, a new restaurant opened in Beverly Hills, and a girlfriend of mine said, let's try it. We walked in, we were seated next to a wall facing each other, and on the wall were a lot of pictures, which I didn't look at because, like girlfriends do, we were immersed in dishing and gossip and conversation, and I didn't look, and we ordered, whatever, and for some reason I glanced to my right, and, oh my God, there's a boat that says Joni. There's my dad. That's my pool. right next to me on that wall, and I had never seen it before. I had no idea, but can you imagine sitting there very innocently, and all of a sudden you look, and there's your house and your father and your pool?
That's wonderful.
Really, you know, all of us remember when we were kids saying, mommy, can I have this? Daddy, can I have that? Mommy, will you buy me this? And, of course, usually what my parents said was, if I asked my father, he said, go ask your mother. And if I asked my mother, he said, go ask your father.
I had very much the same thing.
Really?
Oh, yes.
What kinds of toys did you ask for, and what kinds of toys did you get growing up? What were your favorite things?
Well, this sounds so strange that I'm embarrassed to tell it. My favorite things was music. I wanted another record. I wanted another popular song, and at that time they were the breakable records. You know,
the 78s.
Yes, exactly, the 78s. And I had all what was on your hit parade, all the latest songs, and for some reason I developed at a very young age an affinity for classical music, and I wanted another Beethoven symphony, or I wanted the Chopin waltzes, and isn't that terrible to say those are my favorite toys?
Really?
I think that's wonderful.
Did you have a... I had a record collection when I was a kid, too. And we had those little kiddie record players that you'd wind up. I mean, we're not talking... we're not ancient here. But even when we were kids, we had those ones that you would wind up, and then the ones that had the big old round reproducers is what the name of it was. I don't know if you... You probably don't know it like that because you don't collect phonographs like I do, but had the big round reproducer, and the sound didn't come out of the speaker. The sound actually came out of the playback head, of the thing that was holding the needle. Is that the kind you had?
Well,
you probably had stereo.
I would like very much to say that that was before my time.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
But I did have a wind-up radio.
Well, there's a guy sitting in our studio tonight who is a faithful listener and a very faithful supporter of Yesterday USA. His name is Jay, and he came to visit with us here. We invite our listeners to come once a year and have a reunion because we think of our listeners not as numbers in the rating books, but instead as friends, as family. So with a big family, you got to have a family reunion, and that's what we're doing this week here in Hollywood. And this particular member of our family has come all the way from Tokyo, Japan.
Wow.
And Jay, welcome to Hollywood. And what is your question for Miss Joan Benny?
Well, hello, Miss Benny.
Jay,
I
call me Joan.
Well, thank you very much for letting me call you Joan. As you can hear from my voice, I am scared beyond belief. I have so many famous people around me, and I am pretty much just a nobody.
Well, honey, so am I.
I used to be one, but I didn't.
Know that I just finished doing the dishes. I made dinner, and I just finished washing the dishes and scrubbing a pot.
Great.
I'm cooked in, so I'm not very special.
That kind of describes my
what
life.
What else?
Well, anyways, I've heard in the past about everybody making jokes about Jack Benny's toupee and his...
He never wore one.
Never wore one?
Never.
Ah, that was going to be my question. Exactly what happened to all those toupees? He never wore one. That answered that question.
He had.
Well, who started that joke? Where did that story, where did that shtick come from, as we say in the business?
I think that came from the writers. Who I think, for humor, wrote that he wore a toupee on radio. And I think Rochester took care of his toupee, something like that.
Right.
But the truth is that when he got older, he had a little bit of a bald area in the middle, not his forehead, but in the middle of his head. And he used to use cork to black it up a little.
Right. Now, a lot of people don't understand what you're saying there. What you would do is you would take an ordinary cork, like you use to go fishing with.
Right.
And you take out a cigarette lighter or a match.
Burn it.
And you burn it.
That's old.
And it gets black and it smells terrible in a hurry. And then you rub that on the area that you want to be black.
It's an old trick from vaudeville.
Mm-hmm.
Burnt cork in the minstrel days.
Covers that little bald spot.
And we all thought Ron Popeil was so smart.
but Jack also, from his writer's persona, was the skinflint and the cheapest man in the world and everything. And I think Joan will back me up. A, the nicest man in the world, and B, certainly one of the most generous. So writers can do terrible things to personalities. As a writer, I can say that.
True, absolutely true.
Tell me a Roscoe story.
Rochester,
thank you. Had the first letter right. Tell me a Rochester story, and tell me a Phil Harris story. Something that might tickle our funny bones or surprise us, perhaps.
Well, you don't realize it, but those are very mean questions because you don't have answers. this is the truth, the real truth. Like all of us, my father had three kinds of friends. We all do. We have our buddies, like for girls, for guys, the guys you go drinking with or the guys you play golf with or whatever. You then have your couple friends, the couples you see at night, you go to movies or you double date or whatever you do as couples. And then you have your business friends. And my father had, like anyone else, three kinds of friends. And the cast of his radio show and television show, they were business friends. Consequently, because people ask me so often, you know, tell me about Rochester. The only thing I know about Rochester is I saw him every Sunday. I got a kiss and a hug because I was the star's daughter. And it was always very nice to me. And it was, you know, hi, Rochester, how are you? I didn't really know him. I didn't really know his family. And the same could be said for Phil Harris. I didn't really know him. He wasn't a buddy, neither Rochester nor Phil, nor Dennis Day, nor anyone else, nor Don Wilson. None of them were my father's buddies, and none of them were couple friends. The couple friends were the Gary Coopers, the Jimmy Stewarts, George and Gracie, the Danny Kays, and on and on. Those were the people, those were the couples who came to our house, and et cetera, et cetera. The buddies, one person, two people on the show who were really buddies of my father's. One was Mel Blanc, and the other one was the guitarist in the orchestra, Frank Remley.
Frank Remley, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then he had a lot of other buddies, but they weren't necessarily in the business.
That's very true.
The cast were business friends. And so I'm very hard put when somebody says, tell me about Dennis Day, or tell me about, I don't really have anything to tell.
It's because the writers were so good, and your mom and dad were so good to follow the lines that they did. Because us as listeners, we could just see all of you guys together.
Yes,
every Sunday afternoon, and we cannot imagine what you just described to us after having listened to these shows, because they were so well written and so well acted. And I think that's why you get this question so often.
Mm-hmm. Well, people, of course, assume that I really knew Rochester well. But as I said, I really didn't. I'd met his wife, I met his son, but I didn't know anything about his life. I mean, I didn't play with them. We didn't go to their house for dinner. No. They didn't come to ours. Any of those people, with the exception, as I said, of Mel Blanc, whom I adored. I drove the poor man crazy.
Did he ever make...
He was a lovely man.
Did he do sound effects for you? Did he do voices for you?
Well, he did everything.
I saw him. It was
he played all the parts that the other guys couldn't play.
Terrible. I never left the poor man alone. You know, Mel, do Bugs Bunny, do Tweety Pie, Sylvester. Oh, Lord. And he was so sweet, he always did.
Now, there was always, you know, he was the person in the basement taking care of the vault. And it was the train conductor. And, you know, Mel Blanc was fantastic.
Oh.
And
he was the car. He was the bear.
Oh, he was everything. You know, he was the Maxwell and the whole thing. But the
was when he did the Maxwell. That knocked me out.
Oh, yeah. But the other people, you know, Eddie Anderson, Rochester, it was a great part. It was nothing like him as far as anybody I ever met that knew him. He played that part, and they gave him a script, and he was Rochester on that show, and when he was doing something else, he'd be Eddie Anderson doing whatever he does, you know.
Joan,
and
I
think the same thing was with Phil Harris, because Phil Harris was a lovely, nice man, you know. Phil Harris and Alice Faye, and lived a lovely life, and it was very little like the radio persona of, you know, the drunk leading the band, you know. Although he probably was drunk, and he probably led the band, I don't know.
Dennis was exactly like he was on the show. He was an Irish Catholic, mm-hmm. married to a lovely girl named Peggy, and they had a gang of children,
mm-hmm.
and none of whom I knew, really. But who was I going to talk about? Now I've lost it. Oh, I had one more thing to say about Mel, because I think it's funny and sort of terrible. When he was quite ill, shortly before he died, I went over to visit, and I got to the front door, and the thought that went through my head was, Joan, don't ask him to do Tweety Pie.
Joan, you said when you went on the set that you said hello to Rochester. Did you say hello, Rochester, or did you say hello, Eddie or Mr. Anderson?
He was Rochester to the point, once he became Rochester and became such an important character, and that voice. I mean, I think of all the cast members, people knew Rochester better than any of the others, and even his wife called him Rochester. I don't call him Eddie again.
Well, now, I was talking with Parley Bear once, and he was the mayor on Mayberry, and he said that when Ron Howard was on for so many years, of course, and he started out as a very small boy. And I said, what went on the set? And they said, well, they had a little bicycle for Ron to ride. And when Ron would get fidgety, they'd get out this little bicycle, and Ron would just ride it all around, all over the place. And then they'd say, okay, Ron, it's time to come over here and have some more fun over here. What did you do did they have a special place for you to sit? Did you bring along any toys to the studio? What was it like when you went to the studio with Mom and Dad to do the radio show? Did they have a babysitter for you? What was that like?
It changed over the years. When I was quite young, I suppose maybe from 6 years old on, before that I didn't go. I wasn't allowed to. But when I was old enough, to mind my manners. I didn't go with them because my parents went early because they had a rehearsal before the show. They did a rehearsal for timing before they actually did the show. So I went with someone else, either I think it was my nanny or my governess, whatever, and I would arrive there, and I sat in the sponsor's booth, and that was my place, which was, you know, a room behind glass where VIPs sat to watch the show.
Mm-hmm.
And,
Milt, what am I failing to ask this lady? We're so lucky to have her here. Straighten me out. You're so much better than I.
Oh, I'm just enjoying the conversation, and I think you're doing a wonderful job of asking questions. Now, Joan, I think you're doing a wonderful job of bringing up some wonderful things. I was just such a great admirer of your father's. I mean, I can't think of anybody that I would idolize more as, you know, when you're a comedy writer and trying to look for the best that you can find, and Benny was always the finest, in both as a gentleman, as I say, my brother worked with him, and you know, I have never met anyone in this business that ever had anything bad to say about Jack Benny, and in this business, everybody has something bad to say about everybody. And you know, I mean, it's truly. I mean,
well,
you can't go through life and talk about any major entertainer and not find somebody that really hates him from some, you know, maybe he didn't lend him $10 of 50 years ago, and they said, well, that miserable rat, you know. But I never heard anyone say anything against Jack Benny, and I think that is the greatest compliment that anybody could ever have in life.
No, yeah. That's certainly true for me when I interviewed a lot of people when I wrote the book, and to somebody, I can't remember who it was now, but somebody I knew rather well, I said, can't you think of something bad? The book is getting so boring.
Yeah, you know, as you say, how can you sell a book that's nothing but nice things?
But nobody could think of anything to say about him. So, I mean, he was the most wonderful father, and he was the nicest man I ever knew. He was just a dear, sweet person.
Who was the easy one? If you were in trouble and you had to tattle on yourself, who would you tattle to? Would you tattle to Mama, which, of course, was Mary Livingston, or would you tattle to Daddy? Who was Jack Benny?
Well, let me put it this way. I would try Daddy, but Daddy always said, go see your mother. So I never got away with much.
Yeah, he'd say, well.
Walden Hughes is standing by with a just dying to ask a question, and if not, he's fired.
Well, I was just thinking, Bill, you know, last week you and I interviewed Margaret Truman, and I know Jones has a famous story that she told in a book about not meeting Harry Truman. Can you tell us that story, Joan?
Oh, you want me to tell that?
Yeah, that's a great story.
Well, I have to preface it with talking about, you know, it goes apropos of my father being a nice man. My father, and I mentioned the friends. Okay, my father didn't rate his friends. It didn't matter whether it was Cary Grant or whether it was Frank Rembley. His friends were his friends. And I don't think it occurred to him that other people might have slightly different views. There was no caste system to friends. So, with that in mind, I had just given birth to the first of my two daughters, and my parents were at the hospital with me at the time. And then the following day, this was back in the days when you stayed in the hospital 3 days. They didn't shove you out at the same time the baby came out. And so the next day, my father showed up and came to visit, and this now is the following day, and I was going home the day after that. So, my father doesn't come to see me, and about 6 o'clock, the phone rings, and my father, and he said, Joni, I did the dumbest thing today. I said, well, what did you do that was so dumb? He said, well, I came to the hospital to visit a friend, but I didn't think to come to see you. And I said, don't be silly, Daddy. The hospital is in a whole different area. The maternity wing is, you know, a mile down the road. So there's no reason why you should have. I said, plus the fact that you were here yesterday, and I'll be home tomorrow morning, and you'll come over to the house. I'll see you tomorrow. So don't worry about it. He said, well, it was really stupid. And I said, no, it wasn't. He said, yes, it was. I said, no, it wasn't. He said, well, you know, I came to visit, I think it was Lou Wasserman. I came to visit Lou Wasserman, and Harry Truman and I came down. I said, what? Did you say you were with Harry Truman and you didn't come to see me? That's how I never got to see Harry Truman.
That's wonderful.
Let's switch to our microphone in downtown Tokyo for another question from Jay, who's come all the way from Tokyo, Japan, to see Frank Brzee's lovely studio and home, and to ask you a question, Joan Binney. So here goes, Jason.
This is actually kind of a, I guess, a serious question. Your father and mother were, well, basically married for life, right?
They were.
What was their secret?
I wish I knew, because it didn't happen to me.
Oh, celebrated my 10th anniversary, and yeah, usually about maybe three times a month, the thought of strangling my wife pops into my head. And, you know, I'm thinking, oh, I got, what, 25 more years left? And so maybe any pointers? Hints?
Well, excuse me. I'm not sure that the hints would be from my... I'm being very serious now. I'm not sure the hints would be from my parents' marriage, because I don't think that their marriage was in any way typical, as show business marriages are simply not. You take a performer, and I think that, it, as I say, it wasn't a typical marriage. My father was very wrapped up in the next show. He was very wrapped up in what he was doing, and he didn't. He lived in a kind of bubble, and he didn't concern himself much. And I think my mother learned early in the marriage out of his way. Not that he was angry or anything, but just she knew he was deep in thought. And she knew he was thinking about the jokes for the next show or who the guest star would be or whatever. And he understood that. But that's a very different kind of marriage than your normal kind of marriage. Hint, I don't know. I have a daughter. I mean, my marriages didn't work out. I have a daughter who is celebrating her 50th wedding anniversary, and the two of them absolutely worship ground the other one walks on. They're madly in love, and I don't know what the, you know, who knows what that secret is. It works or it doesn't.
Well, I'll tell you what the secret is for me. About every 4 or 5 years, I buy a new house and a new car and give it to somebody I don't like. And that's the premise that I worked under until about a year ago from last April. And that's when I met Kim. And now we are as happy as anyone can be. And so that is the only advice that I might be able to give.
And I think so much of it has to do with luck. Find a partner that really suits you, and you suit her.
That's so right, and it was great luck for me. My wife heard me on the radio in a far, far away place from Texas, from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. She was working for the governor, and she heard me, and she said, hey, this guy is better than the governor. And she quit her job, and she came to Texas, and we got married and celebrated our first anniversary. In April. What day, you say? April 27th, I believe, would be a day that might bring a smile to your face.
No.
That won't be. That won't be. One, two, three.
You were thinking of my anniversary, which is August 27th.
Right. Well, we need to get Bob Barker in here and play the high-low game, you know? I got the month right, though, by golly.
Who's August 27th?
The 27th. No, it's April.
Voice was saying it.
Right. I'm nervous. I'm on the radio, and this is not the first mistake I've made this evening. So please do bear with me.
Daughter's and anniversary.
That's right. The Internet's not in front of me. I usually have a computer, and I can go to the Internet and click on Bill and Kim's wedding, and it's all right there in front of me. Where we got married, what city, it's all there spread out for me. Joan, tell me about your dad's best friend, George Burns. Am I correct? Wasn't that about his best friend?
Oh, they were joined at the hip. They were hilarious together. It was, are you there?
I'm listening to every word that you say.
Oh, it got very quiet. I thought.
That's because we want to hear every word. We can hear us anytime.
Now, I have to say that thanks to George Burns, I had a childhood filled with laughter because the two of them together were nothing less than hilarious. They were it was constant. It never stopped. They had what I would call a symbiotic relationship. My father could never make George laugh, and George lifted his hand, my father was on the floor. And it was so ridiculous. I mean, I'm sure you've heard all those stories, but George driving down Sunset one day, and my father was walking on the other side of the street, and George stopped, rolled down the window, and said, "Hi, Jack." And my father saw George and started across the street, gets across the traffic on Sunset, gets to George's car, and he rolls up his window and drives away. And when my father called George in St. Louis, George had just married Gracie. And my father heard about it and called them at their hotel in St. Louis. And the minute George heard my father's voice, he said, "Send up two ham sandwiches and two bottles of Coke," and hung up. So father, dummy that he was, I mean, my father was always the sheep, you know, he was always patsy. So my father, of course, calls him back, and George says, "Be sure the Cokes have plenty of ice," sandwich, and hung up again.
when they got together, was it like a lot of times, you know, two couples will get together and the guys will pair off in one room and maybe the girls will go to the kitchen or whatever. Is that the way it was, or was it all four in the same room?
I don't remember that. Because when they came to my house as a couple, it was a dinner. I mean, first we all sat in the den before dinner and had drinks, or they did, and then we went to the dining table. I was only at the dining table, I think, when their two kids were there, when the children were invited. And mm-hmm. So then it was family dinner. There was never any pairing off. It was always everybody together.
Mm-hmm.
And then after dinner, I don't know, we'd run a movie or whatever. They were generally early evening. But it was constant laughter all the way around. George was just so funny. I can't even begin to describe it. And then he'd get a little naughty. Not really off color, but a little bit naughty. And if he got a little bit over the line, I can still hear Gracie saying, "Oh, George."
You know, it's interesting to think about how times have changed. And and nowadays, if you went to somebody's house and lit up a cigar, they'd call the police.
I don't even want to discuss that. That makes me crazy.
Right. I guess George had a cigar in his hand when he rang the doorbell, didn't he?
Of course.
And kept one, I guess, probably lit in an ashtray by his plate while he ate.
Probably so. I mean, he was never without the cigar.
Right. And, boy, we can't do that today. And that's a shame. And, of course, what's even more ashamed is that we don't have people like your mom and dad here with us anymore. George Jones has got a song out, you know, "Who's Gonna Play This Old Piano After I'm Gone?" And who's gonna stand on the stage and make us laugh now? I don't have as many laughs now, Joan. Do you, Milt, do you have as many laughs nowadays as you?
Well, the one thing that I think we're missing is Jack Benny and George Burns and a lot of the great comedians could make people laugh with good, clean family humor and comedy that came from the heart and comedy that came from situations. And I get very distressed when I watch... I watch very little television because I get very easily distressed. So I prefer to hang around a bar at the Magic Castle. You see some of these so-called comedians today who have no idea of structure. You know, the one thing about Jack Benny and Burns is they grew up in vaudeville, and they were able to learn about timing and construction and all that sort of thing. My comedy writing mentor was a fellow by the name of Snag Waris, who was a burlesque comedian, ended up as the head writer for the Jackie Gleason show and many other shows. And he would hit me with a baseball bat if I didn't pay the thing. What do you mean you didn't go bing bang boom? You went bing bang boom boom. Oh, that you can't do that. You know, the punchline was on top of the punchline. And I don't think the comedians today really have any respect for the quality of the teaching of comedy. And by that I mean, if you hired a brain surgeon to work on your brain, I don't think you'd want to have one that didn't go to some sort of school to figure out how to do that. You know, and to me, the younger crop of entertainers, some of them are very, very successful, but they just don't have the knowledge of having grown up in the Hard Knocks school. And that's where, when Jack Benny was, you know, playing the violin before he knew how to tell jokes, and he found out that more people would pay for comedians than violinists, and they worked himself up. And that timing is everything. Jack Benny is probably, I mean, if you take the top of any field, you know, Irving Berlin was a top songwriter, Charlie Chaplin was a top silent comedian. Jack Benny probably had the greatest timing of any comedian that has ever lived. And witnessed some of the radio shows where he'd say one word and the audience would collapse for the day. But it was the timing of the setup line and the punchline, and then, of course, he looked at the audience in a proper way, and he could keep a laugh going for a minute or 2 minutes. And a minute of laughter is a century, you know.
Long spread.
It was amazing. I just, you know, as I say, you just have to say that there are a lot of people today that will never know how great it could be if they give comedy a chance.
Those people, of course, you realize that you talk about vaudeville. My father was in vaudeville for 20 years. That's a long time.
Really?
Well, he went into radio in 1932. And 1912 was when he first went on the road. Vaudeville. So he was there for 20 years. That's a lot of background and a lot of school.
And that's doing two and three shows a day.
Yes, of course.
For all that time to different audiences. I read something that he wrote at one point, and he said the reason that training ground was so great is because you could be really bad in a small town, you know.
Exactly.
And nobody would care that you were really bad except the people that saw you. And maybe a year from then, you would be better, and you'd come back, and those people would say, oh, that kid got better. But in the meantime, you weren't killing yourself. Today, a comedian could go on national television and be destroyed in one sitting and never have another chance probably to come back, you know.
In fact, vaudeville was a wonderful training ground.
Oh, yeah.
We don't have vaudeville. We don't have many of the legitimate theaters like
burlesque.
We used. There were tons of theaters. I mean, I drive down, Kim and I have driven all over Hollywood the last week or so. I've never seen so many theaters and places that used to be theaters in all my life. And the problem is, nowadays, you can be unheard of 1 minute, and you can be a $50 million a picture star the next minute.
And the next minute, you could be unheard of again.
Exactly. Right. And there's no place to be bad,
right.
except on television or in the movies. And unfortunately, there's a lot of people on television who are being bad there.
I think another sad part is that there are places, but they're the, you know, the comedy clubs and all that sort of thing. And unfortunately, again, it's the humor that is vulgar and tasteless and not having any construction. You would love to see a vaudeville type of entertainment where, you know, I'd give anything to find some place where I could see a really good comedy juggler or a, well, you know, you see Magic Castle is as close as you come with magicians and an occasional juggler and a ventriloquist or so. But there's really no variety left anymore.
Is Zach still in Las Vegas? I don't know, but I...
Oh, yeah. Sure. Well, Vegas is still, you know, wonderful. But there's no small time in Vegas. You know, you either go there as a star or not.
Right.
And it doesn't mean to me that you can't do it. There are kids all the time that are coming up, and they're wonderful. But if you really think about it, the ones that make it are ones that have been working and working and working and working and maybe playing the cruise ships and doing all that. There's a whole wonderful area for people to be bad in now, and that is the cruise ship.
Mm-hmm. I know. I've been on quite a few as a speaker, as a hired mm-hmm. hand.
Oh, yeah.
They're great. Very cute acts on cruise ships.
Oh, sure. But it's, you know, that's where your vaudeville is today, and mm-hmm. cruise ship and corporate shows and all that sort of thing.
You know, I was on a cruise ship, and lucky for me, it was right after my first divorce, and they had a talent show, and I decided, I think I'll try out for the talent show, and I went up and got up on stage, and I was going to tell a few jokes just to see what would happen, and it was so easy because all I had to do was talk about my ex-wife. And everything I said, you know, I said, boy, she was a great cook, I know she was. Because I came home early one day and there was a truck driver eating there. And I said, on top of that, she was a great little housekeeper as well, because now that I think about that, she still got the house. And I brought the audience down, and people said, man, Bill, you ought to take this show on the road. So when I got back to Dallas, I went down to one of the comedy clubs that you spoke of. And I said, I've got a routine I want to try. And they said, okay, we'll put you on. And we'll put you on near the end of the show. And I sat out there in the audience, and I listened to all these people, some of the most vulgar language I have, from women, too, mm-hmm. that I had ever heard in my life. And I thought to myself...
Your ex-wife.
And she was up there as well, cussing like a sailor. And I thought to myself, where are these people going to go when they step off of this stage? Where else can you perform like that? And this is not where I want to perform. So consequently, tonight is the second time I've told jokes in public. I just gave up because I couldn't be on the Tonight Show, and I didn't want to be in the comedy shops and talk nasty.
Great.
Well, Milt, tell me, as a comedy writer or as a writer in general, there's something that has occurred to me. I don't watch the sitcoms today because most of them are so bloody awful that I can't sit through them. The writing, when you talk about learning your trade and the discipline of writing, and I remember the writers on my father's show writing to a punchline, and it seems the writers today are writing from the punchline backwards. Am I crazy?
I think you're absolutely right. You know, Jack had the greatest writers in the world, Hal Goodman,
and they were with him forever. Forever,
yeah. And but the proper way to write a sketch, a sketch would be the same as a sitcom, let's say, where a burlesque sketch or a comedy sketch. My training in that was you really start with the blackout, which is the end. You do the setup at the beginning. They used to say in burlesque, you know, here we are in sunny Spain. Here we are in sunny Spain means that you set up everything in the first line. You know, here we are at the corner of Madison Avenue and Broadway, waiting for our two girlfriends who have just come out of the drugstore. Well, you know, now you know where you're going, and then you go for the end, which is the blackout or how you get there. Now the middle is filled up with comedy lines, getting you from the beginning to the end, and what I don't see happening in today's comedy writing is they don't have a beginning or an end. All they have is the middle. Seriously. I mean, and how many times you see some comedian on the Jay Leno or on, any shows, and they do joke, you've been a great audience, good night.
Well, and
I mean, they're not going anyplace, you know. Gee.
Telegraphed, which drives mm-hmm. me crazy, because you know what the punchline's going to be.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember, I mean, you'll relate to this, because I think my father's most famous joke was, you know, your money or your life.
Oh, yeah. I'm thinking.
Well, and this was typical of the way the show was written, is the show was always written from situation. My father was walking home from Ronald Coleman's on a dark night from Ronald Coleman's back to his house, and you heard the footsteps, and then whatever one of the writers said, something to the effect of, let's say a burglar holds him up. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a good idea. Okay, a burglar holds him up, and he says, your money or your life. Well, we've got that far. And then it was, I don't know how long before, and you know the story of how the punchline was written. Yes? No? Maybe?
Remind us again. I forgot.
Oh. We have a whole audience out there.
So it was written in two parts. The first 15 minutes, there were four writers, and two of them did the first 15 minutes. They called the other two and told them where they cut off so that they'd know where to pick up, and the other two writers wrote the second part. At any rate, it was, I believe, Tackerberry and Josephsburg who were the pair, and they set up this situation. And that's what I'm talking about when you go from the setup, that you have a situation, and you don't go from the punchline backward, because neither of the two knew what the punchline was going to be.
Mm-hmm.
They simply had a situation. And so they got as far as, okay, the burglar says your money or your life. Okay, Tackerberry, come up with a punchline. Well, I don't know. You, Josephsburg, you do. And Josephsburg is pacing the floor, and Tackerberry's lying on the sofa. And finally, there's long silence, and Josephsburg looks at Tackerberry and says, well, say something. And Tackerberry says, I'm thinking of
That's wonderful.
That's how the punchline was written. Pure act.
That's beautiful. But that was that
great comedy.
That one moment where, you know, anybody else could have done that, but because of the buildup of the Jack Benny
Carrot.
Personality,
uh-huh.
and the fact that we all knew who he was and the way he thought, and the fact that the biggest thing in his life was the penny pinching and everything, and then to have that line set up, and all he had to do is stop, and that's where I get to be the timing. He waited the precise amount of seconds, mm-hmm. then said the line, and without seeing it on radio, I was talking earlier about seeing radio, but you knew what he was doing, and you knew that at that point he put his hand on his hip and looked at the audience, and there was a long time before the show could continue on that one line, you know.
Exactly.
One of the greatest lines in the history of comedy writing.
Joan, you've been so kind and so generous with your time tonight. Let me go ahead.
Pardon me?
I said, go ahead. Were you going to say something? We have Radio Shack here.
The greatest lines, and I said yes, and it was a total accident. I mean, it's wonderful how things like that happen.
It really is. It really is. And it's no accident that we have had a wonderful visit with you tonight. You've been so kind and so generous with your time. Let me ask you one final question. You alluded to the Ronald Coleman story. If not, who was your next-door neighbor? Were the Colemans really your next-door neighbor? Who'd you?
Well, this is another one of the... I'll be quick because I know we're getting to the end, but this is a funny story, too. Is so many of the setups and the things on my father's radio show as well as television, some were real and some weren't. And there was no way that the audience would ever know which was real and which wasn't. It was arbitrary. I mean, my mother's sister, Babe, was a character on the show. Well, it's true. My mother had a sister named Babe, so that was true. On the other hand, the Ronald Colemans were never our neighbors, and nor were they close friends. Now... later on television, Jimmy and Gloria Stewart became the next door neighbors, and they were our next door neighbors. So that was true, but the Colemans wasn't. So it's very hard to know which was which. Our real next door neighbors, we lived in the second house on the block. In the first house were Lucy and Desi. Then you cross the street, and the very first house on the next block was Jimmy and Gloria Stewart. So those were our neighbors. We also had across the street Agnes Moorhead, Ira Gershwin, Jose Ferrer. It was quite a block. Eddie.
And Oliver Berliner.
Yeah.
And there goes the neighborhood.
And at the end of the block was Eddie Cantor. That was
Wow. Now, Joan, I'll bet, I don't know if the farmer's market was here at that time.
Yes.
But even if it was, I'll bet your mom and dad never had to go to the farmer's market because they had fresh vegetables delivered to their door from the Jimmy Stewart garden. Is that is that right?
No, it actually, I don't think we ever did. But, we were invited there from time to time, and I certainly knew their garden. But I don't think we ever had, well, I think when we were there, Gloria would give us things to take home. But, no, the shopping was done at the farmer's market. Really was.
Joan, we love you so much. You've been so kind and so generous tonight and on other occasions as well. We love you, and we ask that you will come back soon.
Thank you, Bill. I'd be delighted to.
All right.
I do hope you really mean that invitation to Magic Castle.
Oh, definitely. Give me a call.
I will.
You know where we are.
I will.
Definitely. Seriously, do that.
Thank you.
Good night, Joan.
Good night.
Bye-bye. Good night.
Oh, what a sweetheart she is.
Very nice.